this. Okay. Okay, forgive me. I was writing part of this last night, and I already told a couple of you this, but I'm a little bit sick, and I need it closer. But then I can't see this. What, hold it? Oh, lift the mic up. Like this? And now turn it like this? Does it? Okay. Is that good? All right. Yeah. So, I'm a little bit sick, so it made me a little tired. And I already said this to a couple people, but Jesse likes to quote this to me, that you are, you're more dangerous driving tired than driving drunk. That's how I felt typing this out. So, I'll blame the drunk typing if any of this doesn't make sense. I don't know if some of you can relate to this, but I run away from New Year's resolutions like the plague. If for some people a New Year's resolution provides an opportunity to start over with a clean slate and recommit to tackling some long sought after goal with renewed vigor, for me the whole notion immediately conjures up the guilt I already anticipate I'm going to feel when I eventually, inevitably, fall back into my old habits. Of course, I can't avoid thinking about all the junk I should be clearing out of my life, but adding a broken promise would merely pile on more paralyzing guilt, which would make it that much less motivating to change in the future. It would be much better to implement the reforms without any official fanfare or public announcement, not even to myself. So the story in the Bible that is always conjured up to me at these moments is the parable of the two sons in Matthew 21:28. You know, the one Jesus tells about a man who tells his sons to go work in the vineyard. The first one says, "I will not," but changes his mind and does the work, while the second one promises, "I go, sir," but ends up not lifting a finger. And then there are those damning words. Which of the two did the will of his father? The answer is clear, of course. But Jesus goes right for the jugular. "Assuredly, I say to you that tax collectors and harlots enter the kingdom of God before you. For John came to you in the way of righteousness, and you did not believe him. But tax collectors and harlots believed him. And when you saw it, you did not afterward relent and believe him." The passage is powerful, frightful even. It illustrates that the absolute intolerance Jesus has for hypocrisy, which happily makes me think of villainous people like certain TV evangelists. But it also, especially when I was young, would remind me with stinging, vivid clarity of those times I had promised to clean my bedroom but had no intention of doing so. I drew a direct correlation with that second son and feared sometimes more than a little bit for my soul. So on New Year's, rather than make a formal pledge to God or even myself, I keep my mouth shut. I try to trick myself by identifying something that needs changing and then go about doing it behind my own back. Silly? Well, even Jesus said, "Do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing." I just work at it and hope that my right hand will be pleasantly surprised if and when my left hand succeeds, without the risk of breaking a pledge and that debilitating guilt. Okay, so maybe all this sounds trivial and But the new year has a way of causing us to consider our lives on a more profound level too, beyond the slightly more frivolous commitments to jog more or eat more broccoli. I think most of us want to know if we're on the right path in life. And whatever direction we're heading in, are we living lives that are fruitful, inspiring, empathetic, resourceful? Or do we elicit the opposite attributes from those around us? Are we slothful, oppressive, apathetic, and unimaginative? Those are very different questions, the where are we going and how are we getting there. I'm always much more interested and concerned about the where, and forget that the how I'm getting there is probably much more important. I'm not saying anything new here. We all mock in agreement, justifiably, the eloquent preacher who forfeits his legitimate calling by being a jerk in his private life. And we praise in agreement, justifiably again, the humble missionary care worker who, despite knowing the risks, dies before her time, serving the desperate souls in some war-torn country. But sometimes it's harder to know when it comes to our own lives, especially if you're not an obviously identifiable superhero. I mean, of the care worker turned martyr type hero, of course, not Hollywood superheroes. But it's also probably unfair and simply unhelpful to constantly be given examples of people whose vocation it is to be superheroes of the faith. Of course, people whose career it is to perform exploits for the Lord, who might even draw a salary or monthly support so they can dedicate their lives in service to a specific calling, of course such people are likely at some point in their lives to do something that can be written about in a newsletter in a compelling manner. If, on the other hand, you are a full-time auditor for a real estate investment company, for example, the likelihood, mathematically speaking, that you will have an opportunity to rescue and tend to victims on the battlefield in dramatic fashion are relatively smaller. But it might very well be the case that you're a darn good auditor, or computer programmer, or ballerina, or locksmith, or office manager, or scientist, or between jobber, like I am. It just might be the case that you were born with that set of interests, giftings, and skills that make you good at what you do. There's a good chance that God gave you those gifts and interests because He wanted you to pursue them to the best of your ability. I think sometimes that we don't say it often enough, that like in the parable of the talents, God wants us to take our talents, our money, and our skills and invest them wisely, intelligently, with excellence. This not only pleases God, but it's an obligation. You remember how the ruler in the parable rewards the servants who invest their 5 and 2 talents, but is incredibly harsh with the servant who didn't invest his 1? Imagine, whether it was laziness or ignorance, the ruler calls him wicked and lazy. The servant is reprimanded for not stepping out and taking a risk with his investment. You know, as a child, I always thought it was a bit unfair that, first of all, none of the servants were expressly told to invest their talents. It just says the ruler gave them the talents, and then he went on his long journey. So why was he punishing them for not being proactive? At least he didn't lose the money. But that's just it. Oftentimes, we have no direction. We're just expected to use our faculties and resources God has given us in the most intelligent, caring, even shrewd manner possible. A parable that some scholars suggest could have originally been linked to this one was the parable of the unjust steward. I think because it's a parable that seems a little strange and a little bombastic, it isn't often used in illustrations, so I'll read it to jog our memories. So he said to his disciples, there was a certain rich man who had a steward, and an accusation was brought to him that this man was wasting his goods. So he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. Then the steward said within himself, what shall I do? For my master is taking the stewardship away from me. I cannot dig. I am ashamed to beg. I have resolved what to do. And when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses. So he called every one of the master's debtors to him and said to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. So he said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. And then he said to another, and how much do you owe? So he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. So the master commented, the unjust steward, because he had dealt shrewdly. So the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends for yourself by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. He who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. And he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in what is another's man's, who will give you what is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. So obviously, many people have had problems with this passage because it sounds like Jesus is saying, go ahead and use corrupt means to gain friends, and it'll even secure you a place in heaven. But when you consider that he was speaking in Hebrew, some of these phrases may not be what they seem in English. There is some irony and wordplay here, but essentially Jesus is drawing attention to a corrupt manager who has been caught, but is shrewdly extricating himself by making reparations and implicating his superior in the process. This manager knows he's about to get fired, so he's going to need friends if he doesn't want to end up on the streets. But instead of just trying to embezzle more money, like he probably was doing until he got caught, by cutting everyone else's debts, he created loads of goodwill towards his boss that he would now have no incentive to reverse. The fascinating part for me is that in a complicated, messy, real-world situation where someone was seeking to come clean, even if under duress, Jesus highlights a solution that is as crafty as it is clear. He seems to be saying, following me doesn't entail becoming so dogmatic that you become blindingly dumb. I felt a bit like that in one of my jobs in the States. Dogmatic and dumb, I mean. I remember telling my colleague how I was going to fulfill my new role and the principles I was going to maintain in the position. He just looked at me with a mix of wonder and revulsion and gave me some career-saving advice and said something like, Danny, at what point did you think this job had anything to do with you? Your job is to make the boss look good, and if you can do that, then maybe your work will be considered well. I like to think that I didn't go back on my principles, but my colleague did wake me up to my own naivete about professional life and that I needed to adjust my perspective if I was going to survive. That may be what Jesus is saying when he says, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. That sons of light may actually refer to the Essenes, who gave themselves that title and were notorious for being an exclusivist cult-like group who imposed strict, simplistic, and ultimately repressive financial policies on their community. So Jesus may be saying, don't be so dogmatic like the Essenes that you stop using your wits. And the so-called dirty money, or unrighteous mammon, as the Essenes refer to all money that isn't theirs, well, use it shrewdly, but righteously, of course. What I found comforting in that interpretation that I stole from Brad Young is that it explains a difficult passage, but it also acknowledges life in the real world, where there's general societal corruption on the one hand, and sometimes oppressive religious dogmatism on the other. And the light in this situation shines through a story of redemption in a corrupt individual who seeks to make amends. But because he's dealing with the mafia, he has to do so in such a way that no one ends up getting hurt. To be clear, it isn't about moral relativism. No servant can serve two masters, he says. But the world is complex, and in navigating with nuance, he often trusts us to decide where to turn. The black hole that is Syria is one of those crises that defy simple dogmatism. More so than other recent conflicts in the Middle East, the weight of the counter-arguments brought to every proposal seems to crush all motivation except for the worst of the extremists. Speaking mostly regarding what a Christian response to the crisis should be, you can always easily play devil's advocate. We should be supplying aid to meet the needs of the refugees, is the first obvious observation. Okay, but aid agencies are completely overwhelmed, as are the main countries hosting them, like Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey, is a common response. Well, then we should lobby to have other countries to take more refugees. But most Muslim countries that are able will not accept refugees. Europe has taken in over 1 million refugees this year alone, many of them Syrians. But fears of terrorism, demographic trends, and increasing xenophobia are eroding support for welcoming incoming refugees. And here is where positions splinter into all directions. There is an entire spectrum, from those who claim that the threat of terrorism is negligible or manageable, and in any case not a significant threat, and therefore not a reason to impede the flow of refugees, to those who maintain that the threat is so severe that any Muslim is a potential future terrorist, and therefore all Muslim refugees should be barred. And then in between those are positions like, maybe we should allow in varying numbers of refugees, but ensure that they not be granted citizenship rights so that they don't pose a demographic threat in the future. And then the corollary to those is that really the problem needs to be solved at its source. That is, a solution needs to be found to the war in Syria. That's when we as Christians fall on our faces and shatter into 1 million pieces. The extremes in differences of opinions among Christians are so stark and so astounding, I wonder sometimes if our faith has any meaning at all. So just briefly, because I want to come back to here. The Christian minority in Syria, like most minorities in Syria, like the Druze and Kurds, have been tightly bound to the ruling Alawite minority, while their leader, Bashar Assad, brutally imposed his tyrannical rule over the entire country, and especially over the Sunni majority. And when the Sunnis revolted, many Christians genuinely feared that the Sunni rebellion would be Islamist in nature and intolerant to minorities. But even if it had remained secular, they feared Sunnis would want to exact revenge for the many ways that prominent Christians were implicated in the previous regime's dictatorship. In this way, even if Christians were sympathetic to a secularist democratic movement, they felt blackmailed and forced into the only viable option available to them to support the Assad regime. Assad's military may now be fighting notorious terrorist groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. But that is after decimating the more moderate Free Syrian Army rebel group and long after slaughtering the early unarmed protesters. All the while he's embarked on one of the most brutal repressive campaigns in decades, pointedly targeting civilians, killing at least 250,000 of his own citizens. So what has the Christian response been? Astoundingly, there are many Christians who champion the Assad regime as a defender of Christians, as if any means justify the ends. On the polar opposite, I've heard Christians coldly state, those Christians made a pact with the devil, they reap what they sow, as if an innocent majority wouldn't suffer as collateral damage for the sins of a few. And then a great number of Christians are resigned to the inevitability that a Christian presence in Syria is no longer viable and that those who can should leave, as if Christians around the world don't carry any responsibility toward their sisters and brothers when in dire need. You even hear things like, everyone else there is our enemy. Christians should just get out of the way and let them finish each other off. As if we've so lost our ability to see the humanity in the enemy we hate, we've begun to sound like them. Okay, so why bring Syria up? It's so impossibly controversial, and I won't bring it to a satisfactory resolution here. Well, on the one hand, it's not just a trivial mental exercise. It is one of the worst human crises occurring in the world right now. It's happening a stone's throw from here, and we're in a position to do something, however limited, about it. On the other hand, it's an example of how we come to think about issues in distorted proportions. Wherever one stands on the matter, when we think of Syria, the threat that leaps to most people's minds is ISIS, even though the Assad regime targets and kills orders of magnitude more civilians on a daily basis. And honestly, in terms of numbers, Sunni Muslims have been perishing in staggering amounts. But so often the answer, it's complicated, is an excuse for inertia, for doing nothing. And thankfully, I don't think we've shied away from complicated issues here. Although I do wonder sometimes if Jerusalem was in a similar situation, how disastrous and divided the state of the Christian community would be here. Would we take refuge in each other's churches? Would we trust each other? Would we even know how to contact each other to ask if the other needed help? God help us. I don't know the answer to those questions, but the very few meetings of refugees have raised them for me. But I want to be honest about proportions, because I don't spend the majority of my day thinking about Syrian refugees. I'm quite certain I haven't done enough, as much as I should for them. But I don't know that I'm supposed to think about them all day. This is going to sound cold, and it may sound like a complete contradiction to the point I was just trying to make about Syria, that we should think about it often and in a nuanced manner. But it goes back to what I was saying about what each of us does, our skills, interests, giftings, and careers. I'll pick on the auditor again. He can't be that awesome auditor if his mind is elsewhere. If he's going to support his family when he needs to be a good auditor, a dependable auditor, not one who's daydreaming about Syria all day. Okay, but he can volunteer for Syria-related stuff on his free time. Fine. As long as he's also spending time with his wife and kids and helping with the homework end. I think you can see where I'm going here with this. It's not that there's no time for Syria. It's just that for the non-specialist, there's a very limited amount of time available for Syria. In many ways, the challenge of our time is time management. Never before have so many people known so much about a conflict and therefore had the opportunity to do so much. But because we live in exactly that type of media environment, we're mostly just overwhelmed. And that's the challenge. How do we non-specialists budget a reasonable, realistic amount of time? And in today's world, everything is handled by specialists. Only the Amish show up as a whole community to build a house for someone. Everywhere else, builders build houses. No, it takes scores of very specialized professionals who build the various multitudinous parts of a house. There is no one person who is qualified to build an entire house. That very fact, the increased specialization and compartmentalization of life, is what seems to make so many of the biblical examples unattainable. It's virtually impossible to be a good Samaritan if you think about it. I mean, you wouldn't tend to a beaten up, robbed person in that way. Your good Samaritan act would culminate with waiting for an ambulance to arrive. I suppose you could check up on him later, but the Samaritan didn't do that. Even pulling the donkey out of a ditch on the Sabbath wouldn't be a dilemma for you. It would be the phone call to animal services, or whatever they're called. So I want to end by telling you about two people who combine all of these attributes. By that I mean they are both working women in real jobs, in offices here in Jerusalem, and they are extremely busy. They have active family lives, family and social lives. They both happen to be talented writers. I could go on about their talents, hobbies, and interests, but it would give away their identities. The point is, they have all that, and yet when a need or a crisis with a friend or someone in the community presents itself, they still manage to be fruitful, inspiring, empathetic, and resourceful. Because in this hyper-specialized world, people are in need, it becomes all the more critical to have others help navigate from office to office and know what they're doing to decipher each office's highly specialized lingo, telling you why they're not the office you need to be interfacing with, but that you should call this person and that machine and listen to options 1, 2, and 27 before you talk to a human, and oops, the call dropped, start over, and et cetera, et cetera. When you're depressed or ill or otherwise incapacitated, meeting bandits on the road to Jericho sounds better than having to endure the 7 levels of purgatory it requires to schedule an appointment with whoever it is you need to see. I've seen these women tackle getting a friend or even a not-so-close acquaintance through that purgatory with a stick-to-itiveness to see them through that makes you think, this is the one that did the will of her father. Or, this is the kind of light that shines before men, that lets them see their good works and glorify the Father in heaven.